7 after the hour. Present with us, we have Senator Diesel, Senator Coghill, and myself, Chair Dyson. We only have one item of business this morning. It is House Bill 140, Election Procedures. We heard this Senate bill that started out the same way, and on the House side, they added a whole bunch of changes, and Gail, would you like to explain them to us, please?
Good morning, Gail Finumiai, Director, Division of Elections. And as Senator Dyson did say, your committee did hear the Senate version of this bill, Senate Bill 44. There have been quite a few changes in the bill made on the House side, mainly in the House Judiciary Committee. And if it's fine with the committee, I will just go through those changes. As soon as I can find my list. The first change was in sections 3, which requires poll watchers to be United States citizens versus registered voters. Section 4 was amended to allow candidates to appoint poll watchers because currently.
Wait a second. Mm-hmm. This is the / I version.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. Section 4 was amended to allow candidates to appoint poll watchers. Currently, the statute only allows the parties to appoint a poll watcher.
Okay.
Section 5 was amended to require that members of the State Review Board be United States citizens versus the version you heard was registered voters. Section 6 of the bill is an APOC amendment which requires no party candidates to file appropriate APOC reports on the same timeline as party candidates. Sections 7 through 9 amend the APOC statutes related to identification requirements for communications paid for by a political party.
Say that again.
It's related to making changes to the identification requirements for communications in radio ads that are paid for by a political party.
That's the paid for
it has to do that third that tagline,
right?
Because currently, I'm not an expert in APOC, but I believe you have to list your top three donors. I believe it is, or you have to list.
We have an APOC, the executive director online.
Okay, so Paul probably could answer that
Paul,
better.
Can you hear us?
This is Paul Dauphine, sir.
All right. Please pay attention to the discussion here, and there'll be some questions that we'll probably want you to comment as well, and then we'll have your testimony as well. And thank you.
My pleasure, sir.
Section 11 was amended to allow a person requesting an advisory opinion from APOC to have their name redacted if requested. Not an automatic, but if the requester of the opinion wants their name to be redacted, it could be redacted. Section 14 was amended to allow ballots postmarked from overseas to be received 10 days following the primary election and 15 days following the general election.
Let me think about that for a moment. Say it again, please.
Sure. By mail ballots that are postmarked from overseas currently for both elections have up to 15 days to be received. The statute was changed originally to have them all be received by the 10th day. House Judiciary changed that so it would be received 10 days for the primary election to still allow the division adequate time post-primary to prepare for the general. But for the general election, since there is not a need to get ballots mailed to allow a full 15 days.
All right. Mm-hmm.
Sections 16 to 21 were added to include a special election, and a special runoff election to fill a vacancy in the U.S. Senate. There currently is requirements for a special election, but a special runoff election would be included if a candidate in a special election to fill the vacancy for Congress did not receive at least 50% of the vote.
Wow, I bet that'll present some timing problems.
It would be tight, but we could get it done.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Section 22 was amended to move the primary election from the second Tuesday to the third Tuesday. Section 31, again, was related to the special runoff election to fill a vacancy in Congress. Sections 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, 38, 39 were also amended to include language related to a special runoff election. Section 41 added special runoff election to the current definition of a federal election. And Section 44 deleted the repeal of the statute that said all ballots had to be in by the 15th day from overseas.
All right.
That is a summary of the changes in the bill as presented to the State Affairs Committee.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And previous to start, I asked Gail if there were things that her division had problems with here. Would you comment on that?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. The division is fine with the changes that have been made on the House side.
All right. Any questions or comments on Gail's testimony? Please stand by. Mm-hmm. Is there somebody here from the House Bill Sponsor's office? Okay. All right. Paul, please identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
My name is Paul Dauphinet. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Offices Commission. Mr. Chair, I had not intended to testify, but to be available to answer any questions that the committee may have, sir.
Questions? Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Paul. Paul, in Section 8, we're taking the requirement for the paid-for-by statement. Help me understand that. It sounds to me like what we're doing is saying they can just say paid for by X party instead of having a list of donors. Is that the way I understand it correctly?
Through the chair to Senator Coghill, that is absolutely correct, sir.
All right. And then, Mr. Chairman?
Sure. Continue.
Requesting confidentiality, what is there something that brought this forward?
Through the chair to Senator Coghill, I believe that was an amendment put forth by a member of the House. I don't know the exact circumstances that prompted that particular amendment. However, APOC has no issue with it. If people wish to request anonymity when they request an advisory opinion, it'll change our writing style a little bit for those particular requests, but otherwise, the APOC staff doesn't have an issue.
Yeah, I thank you, Dyson. I suspect it was aimed at the problem of someone who makes an accusation of impropriety against a candidate in the few days before the election, and that just the publication of the accusation could have a pejorative effect on a candidate while there's not enough time for them to respond or you all to come to go through your process and make a ruling on it. Am I close?
Mr. Chair, I would assume that's correct. We know as an agency that's when we get attention from the media just in the short periods before elections and people latch on to things. So I would assume that's correct, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Coghill. Senator Coghill.
It looks to me like it's the person requesting the information, not the candidate themselves. So I think the candidate could still bear the brunt of it, and whoever is requesting could be exempt from having their name put forward. That's what I see.
Yeah, and that seems to me not
Chair,
pretty
may
good.
I offer a comment on that, please?
Sir, go ahead, Paul.
For an advisory through the chair to the entire committee, to request an advisory opinion, a third party cannot do that. So whoever requests the advisory opinion is the person who is contemplating doing something. So whether it's the candidate or the a candidate's committee chair or campaign manager, it's going to be associated with the individual who asks for the advisory opinion.
Okay, I understand. Okay, done.
All right, and is there a difference between an advisory opinion and a report of impropriety or an accusation of it?
Mr. Chair, I would say yes. An advisory opinion is a formal process for APOC covered under 1513. When you say an accusation, that would more than likely come from the public. APOC staff does not make accusations.
Right.
The other term you used is not a term in our lexicon. But again, that would not come from APOC. That would come from someone external to this agency.
Yeah, and I wasn't clear on that, and that was what I was thinking of. So if a citizen makes an accusation that a candidate is acting unethically, what happens with all of that? When you guys get that question, what's the your process?
Mr. Chair, before I answer that, I would just say that what you have just posed to me is not necessarily an advisory opinion.
That's correct.
Advisory opinion is a request from someone who I want to know APOC's formal opinion on my ability as a candidate to bring my campaign manager with me in my car to something, and we would give them a formal opinion on that. What you're asking, I don't mean to oversimplify it, what you're asking me is if a person makes an accusation against an individual, what are we going to do? We may or may not look at it. The accusation has to be one where, for APOC to do anything, where it would be contrary to a statute or regulation that falls under the Public Offices Commission's aegis. So someone potentially acting unethically, that would be something we might give them the contact information for the Senate Select Committee on Legislative Ethics, because those things don't fall under our aegis. If it is something that looks like a potential violation, we, depending upon what we have going, we would probably look at it. And I say that since I've been here, at one point we had 10 complaints going at once, and to do some things timely when we have that many things going is difficult because we are limited by statute into how long we can take to either process a complaint and file the report or to process and deliver an advisory opinion. So that's why I hedge a little bit with probably.
I appreciate that. So let's say this is a hypothetical, but it came up last election cycle. Because of I think there was some change in the filing requirements and so on and so forth, and at least it was represented that one candidate came to you all and said, how do I handle this? And that candidate represented that what the staff told him how to handle it. And that candidate says that they went ahead and did it that way. And then through some process, your board made a decision within a few days or a few weeks and said, no, that's not what we wanted. And then the accusation was made publicly that the candidate didn't follow the filing requirements. And I have no idea how true that was, but talk to me about how those kind of things could happen and how they would be handled in the future.
Through the chair, if you're referring to an advisory opinion request, the way our statutes read, if the individual requesting the advisory opinion follows that advice provided by staff, they are shielded from any formal action, from a complaint or any wrongdoing. If the commission does not approve the advisory opinion, the individual is still protected because they were following the advice of staff.
Say that last sentence again, please.
Even if the commission does not approve the advisory opinion, because the individual was following the formal advice of staff, that person is protected from a complaint.
Okay, so what is the phrase formal advice of the staff mean? Does that mean in writing?
To the chair, yes, sir. That is an advisory opinion. That is formal advice.
So that somebody walks up to your front desk there and says, how do I handle this? And the staff person talks to somebody and comes back and says, this is the way to do it. And then later on, but there's no record of what that was said there, apparently the board or you all says, no, that's not the way it is done or should be done.
To the chair, I think I misunderstood your earlier question. Now I understand more of what you're asking me. What you've just referred to is what we call informal advice, and we give very little informal advice unless it's extremely clear-cut. If it's, what is the due date for this report? The due date for your year-end report is February 15. That's very clear-cut. It doesn't depend on context. It's going to be the answer for everybody, and all staff members know that. That we give as informal advice. If it's not something we can uniformly answer literally off the top of our head, we have people formally ask us in writing for an advisory opinion.
And how long is the turnaround on that generally, Paul?
To the chair, 7 calendar days is what we're allowed.
All right. Questions or comments from committee members? Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if I missed this or not, but the looking at Section 7 and I guess it's 7, 8, and 9, where are political parties currently required to list their top 3 contributors?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, that is the way we have been interpreting it. However, we realize that for political parties to do that, with the limitations on contributions to political parties, it's difficult for the party to pick 3. It's meaningless, actually, for a political party to do that.
What are the limitations? How much could a person or organization contribute to a political party that could thus be used for communications in an election?
Through the chair to Senator Wilkowski, I'm going to interpret when you say an organization as a group.
Right.
A group can contribute up to $1,000 in the aggregate per year to a political party.
So,
by a group, it could be a political action committee, a union PAC, or an organization such as that.
Okay. So just the maximum that the maximum contribution that would be, in other words, you got to read this statement saying this: the top 3 contributors, the largest the contribution could be is $1,000, is what you're saying. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, no, sir. You asked me what an organization or a group could do. An individual can contribute up to $5,000 in the aggregate per year to a political party.
Okay, I'm sorry. Thank you for clearing that up.
Further questions?
Yeah. And then this, the special elections. That's probably maybe more addressed to you. But I don't think I have any other APOC questions, Mr. Chair.
Please stand by, Paul.
Aye, sir.
What's, if I could, Mr. Chair, Section 30 and Section 31, what is the change that's being made there? We're doing special elections under AS 1540-142A as opposed to the time limits that were previously in law?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski. Did I say it right?
Yes, you did.
This time? Thank you. Section 30 is a current statute that calls for the provisions of calling a special election to fill the vacancy of someone in Congress, either in U.S. Senate or in the United or United States Representative. 1540-142 is a new section that would require a special runoff election should no candidate in a special election to fill a vacancy for U.S. Senate or U.S. Representative receive at least 50% of the vote.
Gail, so if there's like four candidates, nobody gets 50%, you take the top two?
Correct, Mr. Okay. Chairman. You would take the top two, irregardless of party affiliation. The top two candidates would be face off in a special runoff election.
And is this something that you're suggesting we do, or I'm just curious of the impetus of this? And
Mr. Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, this was an amendment made by a committee member in House Judiciary.
So that's, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
So is that regardless of party then? So I'm just trying to play this out in my head how this would work. Let's say there was an opening for a U.S. senator seat, and so we would have an election. There would be you'd still go through the primary process, or no?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski. Essentially, the special election would be the primary. Only if a candidate did not receive at least 50% of the vote. So then the special runoff would be your, similar to a general, the top two candidates would then face off in a special runoff election.
So there is no primary then, really? There's no Republican primary, no Democrat primary?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Okay, so you could have two Democrats running for a U.S. Senate seat?
Through the chair, that's
highly
correct.
Unlikely, but
yeah, falls out the other party.
Forgive my confusion, but the primary is for the parties.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. I was just comparing a special election to fill the vacancy in Congress that if no candidate received at least 50% of the vote, that election essentially could be compared to a primary, and then the special runoff would be compared to the general election.
All right.
But if I could, but there is no primary. I mean, there is no political primary.
That's correct.
And so you could, it's basically the way it would work is you have a special election, say 20 people throw their hats, their names in the ring, the top two vote getters, if no one gets 50%, regardless of party, would then go on to the
special runoff.
Special runoff. But this doesn't impact elections anywhere else, does it?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilikowski. It's only specific to filling a vacancy in Congress.
Is this a change? I mean, adding a runoff is a change, but is how we do the special election for a member of Congress a change?
Mr. Chairman, those provisions did not change. The only provisions that changed was to add that if no candidate in that special election receives at least 50% of the vote.
Got it.
So what is the current process is there's an open U.S. Senate seat, 10 people throw their names in, the top vote getter is the one who wins?
The chair, Senator Wilikowski, that's the way the statutes are currently written, yes.
No primary?
Correct.
Okay.
Just a runoff. So would you rehearse for me again where a candidate wins the primary, mm-hmm, and then for some reason they are disqualified, unable to continue, or choose to withdraw, then what is the process for replacing that candidate?
Mr. Chairman,
post-primary.
The process would be that the political party of that candidate would replace that candidate via a party petition. they would submit a petition to the division saying, we replace Bill Smith, Republican candidate for, you know, House District 1, with Susie Brown, Republican candidate for House District 1. We request that her name be replaced on the general election ballot.
Yeah, and then how far in advance of the general election can that process work?
This bill makes it 64 days prior to the general election.
And that leaves you enough time to get the right ballots put together.
To get ballots to the printer in time to get ballots in the mail 45 days before the election.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that if it's 10 days before and the candidate primary winner gets run over by a bus, then the ballots go out as usual and we might elect a dead person, and then what happens?
The current statutes wouldn't help that situation either.
Right.
I'm assuming, and Libby from the Department of Laws here might be able to, still a valid candidate, they win, they aren't able to hold office, so then I assume that the governor would take nominations from the party and they would then fill that vacancy. But perhaps Libby from the Department of Law might be able to clarify that.
Right.
I personally have never encountered that situation, so.
I hope you never do.
And I hope I never have to either, yes.
We're talking about if 10 days before the election, the candidate, something happens, and there's, what happens if they win?
I think I need to take, sorry for the chair, this is Libby Baffler from the department. Well, I need to take a closer look at that and evaluate that a little bit more.
Yeah.
I can provide an answer in a few minutes or in writing to take a look through the statute.
I don't think it's going to affect our decision on passing this bill out today. And so
I need to look at it in the full context.
Yeah, it may be one of the things this committee takes up next year.
Okay.
I'll sit hoping that neither of us gets run over by a bus. All right. Any further questions from the committee? It'll probably be my intention next year to talk a little bit about accusations and stuff, alleged ethics. Because I think that's probably where it is. Any other questions from the committee? Any other comments, Paul?
Mr. Chair, no, thank you, sir.
Yeah, we appreciate the difficult job you guys have done, and my experience is you've handled it with class and fairly. So in spite of the criticism you would get, you got at least one fan. All right, anything else from either of you? Is there anybody else here in the audience or online that wants to testify? All right, the administration and Gail certainly feel
the chairman. She had a question.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious why Section 23, 24, 25, 26, you're changing some of the days from 48 to 52 days and from, or not, you're not, someone is, from 48 to 64 days. You talk a little bit about the rationale for doing that.
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, those dates are changed to accommodate the division to be able to finalize the candidate list so ballots can get printed and ballots can be mailed timely. They have to be in the mail 45 days before the election for our military and overseas voters. And that currently the 48-day deadline is only 3 days before the date ballots have to be in the mail. And allowing 7 days for the primary gives us more time.
And then the Section 26, you're going from 48 to 64 days. Is that a similar type of thing?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, that's correct. That would be for the general election.
Any other questions, comments? Want to take a few minutes to look at stuff here before we move this bill? The first part of this, of course, we heard the Senate bill before.
It seems a lot different. It seems
They've added a whole section, but before you got here,
seems like they've added.
It sounded like they were common sense. The department doesn't have a problem with it, but we're glad to take all the time you want.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I know that at one point we had moved the primary to the second week, and this moves it down to the third week, which I think necessitated some of the 62-day issue, I think. That's the way I understand it. And if I'm wrong, tell me, but that's the way I figured it.
For the record, the director of the division.
I'm nodding. Yes, you're correct. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm just more trying to absorb the changes to the special elections and the campaign, the changing of the paid-for buys and not having to report, political parties having to report their top three donors. I don't know that those changes are necessarily in our best interest, the state's best interest, where people want to try to get as much information as possible about who's funding who, you know, how ads are being funded. I don't know that that's in the people's best interest to have less information.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Giesel,
don't the changes actually amplify the amount of information? Perhaps Ms. Fanumi, I could review again the changes by section.
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, are you talking specifically about the APOC statutes?
The paid-for by that Senator Wielichowski is expressing concern about, the special election timeframes. Are those not beneficial?
It's my understanding through the chair, Senator Giesel, that the changes to the APOC statutes relating to campaign finance reporting level the playing field for political party candidates and no party candidates. The executive director from APOC might better explain that, because we don't deal with that section of Title 15.
Senator Giesel.
I thought that, the paid-for by is APOC. Yes.
Yes.
That's true.
You want Paul to comment on that?
Senator Wielichowski hadn't heard that part, apparently,
I was talking about Section 7, 8, and 9, where
right.
We're basically saying political parties don't have to reveal their top three donors.
Paul, did you hear the question?
Mr. Chair, yes, I did. And to the committee, Senator Wielichowski has a point in that with the party not providing a list of three top contributors, there is not as much information going out. However, because of the limitations on contributions, either from individuals or from groups, a good many people contribute the maximum allowed to political parties. So when you have more than three people at that level, which three do you choose? So while yes, you are not providing that information, the other side of that coin is how much is that information worth? Because if there's 15 people providing the maximum, which three do you pick?
And I understand the argument. I just think that rather than throw the baby out with the bathwater, I think the public likes that. I think the public likes the idea that they're getting some kind of a feel for who's funding these advertisements, these communications. And rather than say, well, I'd rather see us dive in and figure out a way that we can keep that information, and rather than just say we're not going to require reporting of any of that information and communications. I just think that's the wrong approach, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, this is Paul. APOC is amenable to however the legislature wishes to go.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
I understand both sides of the dilemma. However, when a party says that they're paying for something, I think it's reasonably understood that, you know, party donors are going to be the main contributors. But the real issue is when you have other special groups trying to figure out what is their top donor list, I think is probably the more important part. Parties generally I think generally understood that you're going to be a magnet for a certain philosophy, but that may not be true under groups that are named sometimes very creatively. So I'm okay with this change.
Senator Senator Giesel.
Mr. Chair, I'm also okay with this change, particularly because the contribution level for those groups other than a political party is so much higher. It's $5,000.
Yep.
Five times what it is to a political party. And so it's unlikely that a huge magnitude of people will contribute $5,000 each.
Oh,
Senator Bilikowski.
If I understood APOC correctly, it was $5,000 for political parties. Is that correct?
For an individual.
For an individual, right. So individuals would contribute, could contribute $5,000 and then...
And a party of 1,000.
I'm sorry?
And a party... limited to 1,000.
A group limited to 1,000.
Right.
So if you had several people contribute $5,000, there are the names that would show up.
Yep.
I think that's a good thing. I think
you
we.
Too.
I think we're talk about transparency and all the time. I think we're taking away transparency here, Mr. Chair. If we agree to this,
Mr. Chairman, are parties required to list donors candidates are under APOC?
Is that true, Paul?
Through the chair, yes, sir, that is correct.
To me, that's transparent.
Well, except in the heat of elections, what's their cycle for listing their donors, Paul? Are they on the same APOC cycle as candidates?
Through the chair to Senator Bilikowski, yes, sir.
That's good.
Any further questions, discussions?
Chairman Dixon, I do have an answer to the question that the committee posed. I reviewed this.
Identify yourself for the record.
Sorry, Libby Backlar from the Department of Law. If a candidate, I reviewed the statutes, and if a candidate on the general election ballot dies 10 days before the election and the dead candidate wins, that vacancy, it's my opinion, would be filled. In the manner outlined in 1540, the condition and time for filling vacancy by appointment, that basically the person would be in office at that point, and that would just be filled through those procedures.
Yep. Thank you.
Questions? Comments? The chair will entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move committee substitute for House Bill 104, version 28-GH1983/I from this committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Is there objection?
Well, I don't think we should be moving this bill at this quick stage, Mr. Chair, but I'm not going to object because I can see how the vote would go if I did. So I think it's too quick. I think we're making some pretty big changes here in a 45-minute time frame, and that's a mistake.
That happens at the end of the session, but it did get a significant amount of discussion and input on the House side, in House Judiciary. All right, seeing and hearing no objection, the bill is passed. I want to acknowledge that as often we have Sam and Nancy helping us, and this will be my staff member Ken Truitt's last appearance, and he is moving on to bigger and better things, but I just want to acknowledge how well we've been served both by Ken and the staff here that have helped us, and I appreciate both your work and your professionalism. And I think we're adjourned, and hopefully for the last time this year, and thank you to the committee members. You've served well.